Arquitetura entre vistas. Your public space for thinking architecture is now going abroad. Welcome, I'm Catarina, no longer a student, not yet an architect. Join me and a guest architect 3 times a month, with new episodes dropping every 3rd, 13th and 23rd. 3 is the number to remember. Each episode on a different place, but always on Spotify. And Instagram and on the website arquitecturaentrevistas.com. Go check it out. Just before we start, a few words from our sponsors.
This episode is sponsored by Daidalos. The legendary print magazine from the 80s and 90s is now an online magazine where profound essays on architecture, art and culture find their place. Curious about what a pineapple has to do with modernity? Go to daidalos.org to know more. I also recommend you to purchase Daidalos' new printed edition. By doing so, you are supporting this non-profit magazine at the same time.
Now, let's talk architecture.
Today, we travel to meet the French architect Gilles de la Leix and the Dutch-Belgian architect Yves Moreau. They are the duo behind Studio Moto, founded in Paris, France, back in 2003. Yet, they are many times tempted to situate the office beginning in 2009, when their first commission started to occur. One could say that they cover the fields of architecture, urban planning, design, teaching and scientific research. But this brief could fit for almost every architectural practice. I consider much more informative to tell that Muoto means form in Finnish. Gilles, usually an architecture intent is expressed in the form of function. That's how people ask us for architecture. They ask us for a kitchen for cooking, a bedroom for sleeping, a garage for parking. So they describe the subject as it is. How is it that you give form to that functional brief? How is it that they ask you for function and you deliver form?
Well, probably because we believe that a building or architecture is not necessarily an answer to a program. It has its own autonomy and usually lasts longer than the activities themselves, which doesn't lessen the importance of the activity, but it takes you in a different direction as you start thinking that many activities can occur over time. So function, in all sense, is okay, but it should be taken in a very wide sense. When we chose our name, I would say we didn't have a clear agenda, so we looked for a quite generic meaning. Muoto in Finnish means form in a wide sense. It means also organization. It means figure, face. You know, it's a very common word in the world of design. So we thought the meaning of the word was wide enough. It's also a word that is often associated with others altogether. So it's pretty much something like a fragment. So for us, it was not to point at something so specific. The most important that it didn't refer to our own names, you know, as authors, but more as something that does not actually exactly says about our own personality or person, which I think is not really the subject of architecture, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was important as a start. We thought what is important is maybe not us, the two of us, because we were working with friends and it was more a small collective organization. And say it frankly, we didn't even know that we would build up an office. We started the office because we had a project. So the office came as a way to respond and to create a project. And it was not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. The opportunity forced you to be architects.
Yes. Yeah, we were doing other things, working for offices, doing academic research, and we're doing small installations, and that was all fine. But we always thought that the world of architecture encompassed much more than designing buildings. You can do books, you can do furniture installation, you can produce reflection, you can think on a wide array of scales. So having to make a building Yeah, makes you become a firm in a way. But I guess our objective is really to touch as many subjects as possible. This is where the fun is, you know. It's the first time you do something, that's where you have the most fun. So mm-hmm. We're always hoping to touch new subjects.
Mm-hmm. So just like architecture is a wide range of knowledge, so is your name. And so are the functions you intend of having in your projects. Almost as if your structures can be appropriated by any function. And this is very complex, but think of me like this. They ask you for a function, as I said in the beginning, and then you develop an architecture that is whatever function. Are you not following the brief?
We do usually follow the brief very carefully, but we're also very careful that the structures that you're talking about can serve anything else. We try to unspecify, say, the dedication, and in return to specify very much the architecture, the width, the height, the capacity of the structure itself. I mean, the structure is very specific. What happens is open to whatever, to the future, anything else, or the people who will use it. I think that came pretty much because we started with public buildings. And you know that in public buildings, it happens that the client is not such a clear person. It's not like one person who says, I want a room like this, this is the way I live. You know, it's usually for users that you don't know. So the question came from that. We just didn't know who were going to use our projects. And from there, function is a difficult thing. You know, a bathroom is not a bathroom. We got millions of ways of doing a bathroom. So it's the same for an entire building. The choices are numerous and you have to make choices. The question was, where do we have to be specific?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So the brief is a good start, but it's not the end. The brief is not the objective. It's the starting point.
Where do we have to be specific? That is the question. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This also reminds me of a theory Peter Eisenman has or theorized. And it's quite curious that you say the word specific, that is a key word. So Peter Eisenman says, if the function stated is vertical movement, then we can produce the response, stair, ramp, or lift. But there is a point at which vertical movement might be thought of in a sense other than the purely utilitarian. This comes up as soon as the ramp, the stair, the lift are thought of as transition, as minor spaces connecting two major spaces. Therefore, the function of this space is no longer conceived as entire utilitarian. It is no longer adequate merely to insert a stair or a lift between the floors of the building. This is end of quote. And I think this is pretty much what you try to do with your architecture. Maybe this is where architecture takes shape, when new layers arise from initially was purely a functional intent.
Yeah. I'm not sure where to end to that quote. I mean, yes, it's true. I mean, there are many ways to interpret it, I would say. I guess the moment where we would converge to that idea, knowing that it's Eisenman's quote, is sort of abstraction of architecture, that simply questions the notion of function. It's true that a stair is not necessarily just a device to go from the ground floor to the top floor. It's a lot more than this, hopefully. I mean, we have many examples. So probably, yeah, we need to question what is a function. We rarely actually talk about function. We usually use terms such as activity or occupation, you know, like sort of a life. I think that's for us, vocabulary that is more usual. You know, it's more about something that fills up the building, and that is a sort of a material that is not so abstract. When you see it, then it's just life, you know. So that's why we don't use that much the idea of function simply, I think, because it has maybe a two causal relation between form and the thing the form is supposed to respond to, you know. So we try to use other words.
Yes, that is true. Actually, in your descriptions and all your articles, the words that come up are activities and so on. I don't remember reading function. That is very correct. And I can also maybe trying to take this out of the abstraction mode. I recall a building of yours that was a project for the Guggenheim in Helsinki in Finland. And you pre-imagined Frank Lloyd Wright's Guggenheim idea leading from the ground floor up to the many different exhibition spaces. But instead of the circular form, you use a double inverted pyramid to do the exact same thing. And I find it a genius idea that with the same form or with the same motto, you use it to achieve the same idea Frank Lloyd Wright did.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of, I think we have regular themes or questions such as how can we climb on a building? I think we do like that for some reason. It's because it's a kind of a temporary appropriation that is, I think, probably takes us back to child's memories, you know, of building cabins, of climbing the trees and stuff. And maybe that's quite a recurring idea. So certainly in the Guggenheim, the real one, the main thing is the ascension, how you go up. Wright's answer is so strong, you know, and the ramp does the job. It does many things at once. So I guess we often wonder, how are we going to take people up? What's going to be the experience? Just not in the Helsinki project. I think something you can find in many of our projects.
Are we talking about the Paris-Saclay University campus?
As well, yes, yes. The stair was inside the building and at the same time outdoor. So it was pretty something between the patio and the stair. Also, it was very wide. Was really big for fire exit, fire regulations, as well as the way you could use the building. So we thought it would be more like a vertical street. So in a way, it relates to Wright's answer of the ramp. We didn't have the means to do a ramp, but the idea was still to find a real continuity between ground floor and the roof. I remember that was in 2012, I think, the competition during the summer, and we had a summer break, and we went to visit both Sana's learning center in Lausanne and OMA's McCormick Center in Chicago. We thought, okay, let's visit them. And we thought both learning centers worked very well. They're very distinct, different buildings, but they have these things of having a very continuous space. There's a whole idea in both of them of an experience of movement, but the continuity was achieved through horizontality. So there we were in a case where we had to superimpose different functions, and we thought we need to find that continuity in a vertical way without having space for a ramp. So I think the idea of the stair coming from this idea.
And it almost feels as if we are just talking about ideas of architecture, almost as if handrails were not necessary for architecture to reach its full potential.
Mm-hmm.
By saying handrails, I could say many others. So I wonder if you want to reach a state of pre-architecture or something like this.
I think we said that.
I also think so.
Yeah, we were trying to sort of regress somehow. I mean, even in the means, in our own tools, we started the office where the world of architecture was quite busy imagining complex shapes with the new computer devices, new means. And we did try that. And for some reason, we thought it was just going in too many directions. And we thought, maybe let's try to think of how that they're going to be constructions. And then from there, how can we do architecture with construction? Any construction does not make architecture. You know, construction can be just constructions. So the question was really, how can we go back to the act, the very direct, immediate act of construction, and turn it into architecture? So I think that's why we started regressing, like by doing 2D drawings, very simple 2D drawings, using quite a limited vocabulary, many coming from the world of the infrastructure, which does not usually belong to the world of architecture because it's not designed. I think we were maybe looking more for found objects that we found in a world of much more technical constructions, you know, take them and shift them, bring them into the field of architecture.
You were saying almost as if while others were exploring the new shapes that the computer could deliver to architecture, you instead tried to give a step back and understand how architecture could respond to construction, or how construction could respond to architecture. I think it's more like this. This is really interesting to put the words like this, because I know architecture and construction are different things, but it is very appealing to take construction as a way to respond to architecture, as if it was a tool.
Yeah. I think usually we work a lot through references. We do search in a corpus. We have a little corpus of things we like, and we try to interpret. It really comes actually from the world of architecture. So that was a step on the side, but it's just a general method, even though it's not really a method, but it's a way to start a project. It's looking anywhere, mostly for construction, could be installations or a bridge, you know, whatever. It usually involves structure, basically.
And maybe you can use this idea of a bridge into a house or into an industry. So if function or the activities don't matter, maybe you can also fuse these industry-like constructions into other architectural functions. Mm-mm. I didn't want to use the word function, but I think we can understand.
No problem.
You care about form, matterless of the activity it is going to have. So almost as if you take something that is inside of a category and you take it out, and you appropriate it with architecture. And I find it very interesting.
So it's about questioning the borders, you know, of architecture. What it's, you know, imagine if you think of architecture as a field, things belong to architecture and others do not. Generally, the stuff that's inside the field is, we usually agree it's architecture. Why? It's part of the books, of the publication. So, okay. We may agree that they're part of architecture, but all the stuff that's around this world is much wider. Why doesn't it enter into architecture? Why not? I mean, that we're just raising maybe the questions of the limit between what is and what is not architecture. How do we define the field? So one way to define it is just to open it, in, not in, in every way, in every direction. It's not like it just, you know, finding specific direction where you say, oh, this is architecture. This could be architecture too. So everything, yes, everything is architecture. We could say as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what is that specific thing that you are now discovering that can be architecture?
It depends on the project, I think. For instance, in the Biennale project, we work pretty much with the technical apparatus of the theater. The wires, the cables, and all stuff that are not exactly part of it. So I don't know how you call it, the coulisses, the back of the building, the things that you usually hide because it's not part of it. We sort of work with that, you know, to develop a specific vocabulary, a specific grammar of architecture.
Yeah, that project is the one with the sphere opened in the half. And then you can see all the wires and all, almost as if it was a huge mirror globe in the dance floor. We can make many analogies looking to that same project, thinking of more utopian ideas of Boulez, Newton's cenotaph, or maybe Walt Disney, Epotec, and Buchmitzer's Fuller.
I mean, the sphere just gave it a more, it's a very architectural figure. For us, it's even more interesting if you find several meanings, you know, certainly by taking something to another field and takes another meaning, then that's even better. Also, we can play the pleasure sometimes, you know, of architects to make jokes for themselves, you know, referring to things and giving them double meanings, playing on shapes, on forms, like, you know, you could play on words, also little jokes that we make for ourselves.
And is it important that people understand it, or can it be just a private joke?
No, sometimes happens we make jokes, private jokes. I would say most of the time, they're not meant to be understood, I would say. We often ask to give explanations, but I don't think a building should require explanations. If it requires explanations, then there's a problem. It means the architecture then cannot speak for itself. Then there's a problem. You have to translate architecture into text. And that was our point at the Biennale. It was not to write and let people understand what they could understand. We knew the meaning was quite ambiguous. It's hard to know exactly what we were saying. I think we had our point, but we didn't want to spell it. The experience should prevail. Otherwise, if you do that, then architecture becomes like just a copy of something, like a photocopy. That again goes against the autonomy of the construction itself.
Mm-hmm. By not needing to explain architecture to people, this does not mean that people should be outside of the discourse of architecture, but that they have the autonomy to appropriate the building the way they want to. Did you ever went to one of your projects and you found some type of appropriation you were not expecting to see?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. I mean, actually the main case, most of the time, nobody uses spaces the way you thought they would. That's the general case. We can always pretend that you make a nice window and people will lean on it and it's just the right size for an average body, you know, but it just never happens. We like to speak about occupation because appropriation usually means that people come and, you know, write on the architecture, bring their own things, make the whole space more personal.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of a public building, you know, if you want to adapt it to everyone, then you just go crazy. You know, you cannot do that. So appropriation has its own limits. You know, appropriation means it's mine. So the idea of appropriation is sort of an absurd idea. And also I think it translates into a strange kind of aesthetics today. What's at stake is that it can be occupied in one way or another, and occupation is different because occupation doesn't have to change literally architecture. Occupation is about, I take your word, it's changing the function. Yeah, the function, you know, there's one function, if you occupy it, and then you turn into something else, then the whole building changes a function somehow. And that's occupation. And it's always temporary because someone else can come afterwards, and then the building would again, change, you know, take on another function. Often use the example of stadiums. You go to an empty stadium, and if you go to a stadium full of supporters during a football match, then it's a very different place. And then you can play an opera, and it will be different again, and the public will be different. So there are structures like this that are obviously open to occupation and not necessarily appropriation. We try to make the distinction. Mm-mm.
So occupation being different from appropriation, very nice detail, very precise. Mm-hmm. So this is about a phenomenon.
It is, has to do with phenomenology, yeah.
And do people feel free and comfortable enough to go to a place and occupy it the way they want? Do we have that kind of liberty to do so?
Freedom always plays itself in relation to constraints. So I guess we're not exactly talking about the great big concept of liberty of doing anything you want. It's about finding freedom. Finding freedom maybe more in the sense of being able to improvise. Improvisation is closer to what we understand by freedom. No? So small practices, everyday life practices. You know, there's a I think Zizek's making the distinction between freedom and liberty, the big concept, and maybe the tactics. Quite different. We're more into the tactics.
Once again, we can turn this back into architecture. Just like liberty plays against constraints, also architecture might play against constraints. So maybe it's the constraints that lead to an architectural response.
Yeah, yeah. Constraints is always there. I mean, we work with constraints and we create constraints. But the question, which one? We think architecture as a dialectic between what you prevent to do and what you allow to do. We always make choices. So I think we should always think of them together.
So if you are allowed to do everything and there are no constraints, then we have a problem?
Yeah, surely. But it never happens. We're totally safe on that side. We don't have too much freedom. It's pretty rare that to be in that situation. I mean, at least in architecture.
So the difficulty in here is, as you told before, your aim is to project an architecture that is left unfinished. And how can you do that when the world, the reality, wants you to finish your projects, wants you to have everything very insulated, everything very protected, everything very closed? How can you leave an open space for architecture?
Well, I think we've tried to develop along the years different ideas, different possibilities. On some cases, we tend to almost reduce the facade, the envelope of the building to nothing, makes it like it's an outside. And sometimes we do the opposite, you know, we just expand the thickness of the facade to a point where it becomes a place as such. I mean, these are two different attitudes, but they're both ways to not finish exactly architecture. I mean, our buildings are pretty much finished most of the time. Let's say they're unfinished only in the idea that we want to keep them in a state that is slightly before the perfect symbol, before architecture closes on itself. You know, there's usually a moment where project become so clear, so perfect that it doesn't call for anything else but itself. That's the problem with us. Sometimes you see buildings and you can read them so clearly, you know, you could say, oh yeah, he wanted to do that. Ah, but probably they said, nah, you can't. So, you know, you can sometimes your buildings, you look at them and they tell you exactly why they're just the way they are. You know, it's too bad. You say, oh yeah, this guy wanted to do that, but I'm sure the client refused, so he did that instead. And that really happens. I mean, you know, we have our own obsessions and our own constraints, pretty much shared by every architect. Maybe, yeah, try to escape that. Yeah, we probably are in an attitude of trying to escape architecture most of the time.
Trying to escape architecture, exactly what architects should do.
I don't know. That's a way of doing it. It's just a way. I reckon it's not a very positive attitude.
I think it is. It's because I think there is another sense than the literal word used. It's architecture without being about architecture. I think that's the main thing.
There's always a reference, but when it's just annoying when it's too obvious, maybe, you know?
Yeah, maybe let's go outside of architecture to try to explain this idea. But we also have lunch, not only to feed ourselves, but also to have a good time. Yeah. Enjoy. Why not to do the same with architecture?
Exactly.
While you were speaking, it reminded me of a very joyful moment you referred. I think it was in a conference. And I have never played basketball on the top of a roof, but this experience is really something I want to have on my bucket list. I don't have a bucket list, but I think I should create one. And playing basketball on top of a roof is one of the things that I want to accomplish.
You should come to Paris.
Talk to us more about that incident you found. I think the construction was still happening while this happened.
Yeah, and it did happen. The story of the building is particular because we had very limited budget and the place was fairly empty. You know, it was intended to be a campus, a very active campus. So we're just doing one of the first buildings in a place when there was no life. And we're so scared that would be left on its own. We're so happy when the first people who came to play basketball on the roof knew to just climb the building as they could because it was still a building site. That was a good moment, yes. Because it was a bit complex, you know, technically to put, you know, it forced us to do so many things, you know, like bring all the machinery, the stuff downstairs in a floor dedicated to it. We had to reverse the whole architecture. The building is almost upside down, you know, just to keep the roof open and flat. And it was such an effort. Is it worth it? I mean, such an effort just to have that flat roof. But when we saw the kids playing, you know, before the building was open, we thought, yes, probably they're coming right now. Then surely it was worth it. It was the effort.
Yeah, and now looking back, maybe this constraint of having the flat roof, the difficulty it was, maybe this is architecture going against architecture. So you're reaching your goals.
Maybe, yeah, hopefully.
A book.
Well, you know, we like science fiction books. We often refer to, I mean, this is obvious for us, but we, you know, this Concrete Island from J.G. Ballard. Also, all the books on waterways somehow, The Four Ecologies of Los Angeles, or Learning from Las Vegas, photo books, photography books, because we don't look at photography anymore. So, you know, we only look at photography on our mobile phones. Suddenly the image has little meaning, less and less.
Maybe Learning from Las Vegas is a science fiction book as well.
Also, the form, the original book was very interesting, very nice. Bit of a sketchbook, you know, with notes and drawings, photographs, references, text, you know, like a scrapbook where it was quite unfinished in a way. It's a nice object.
A place.
Okay, if you go down the office here, take the stairs and you turn right and follow Avenue Belfort, then you go up. And there you have Niemeyer's building from the Parti Communist. It's a beautiful building that does exactly what all the urban planning says you shouldn't do. No steps back, it's curved, it's got glass everywhere, underground space, ramps, and it doesn't touch the walls around, the gable walls. You know, it's just an awful response to a city condition, yet it's the most beautiful building. We absolutely love it. It's just 2 minutes away. And if you go further up north, you have the Green Park of Butte-Chaumont. It's a very romantic park, carved in the ground. Used to be, I don't know how you say, in Carrière, where you would get the material to build the city all around. So that was a hill that had holes everywhere. And one day was turned into a park with fake fountains, fake lake, fake everything. So everything's fake. And yet it's quite beautiful. It's a world smaller. Well, it's not an utopia, but it has something of the world, like a fair little house here. And it's really steep. So you go up and down. And I think it's quite a nice place. And there's a temple also on top of a mountain. And then if you go further away, we go to Parc de la Villette. Remain quite an interesting project. And I think it's quite funny to see what it became today.
You did it with Bernard Tumi?
Yep.
Okay, nice.
Yeah. And then if you go further north, you just can take your bike and follow the canal. Quite an interesting place. You can go straight, you know, for miles and miles and miles, and you cross the whole Paris suburb where so much of our actual culture is coming from at the moment, where that's endless. Then you can go forever. Places we like if you start from the office and go further up north.
Okay, so we got a full trip all over Paris.
Yep.
An architect.
And this one's called Mr. Royal. I'm not sure he has ever existed, but you could search into science fiction books. He's the last remaining man in a tower that is run down, and the last man is the architect, and you can feel that by the end that he doesn't have much to live anymore. He's the last man.
A project of your own.
This one I like that we lost. Like most of them, it's the Tower of Sports in Brussels. And we're so happy with this super industrial thing. We did look at a lot at the Becher's photography. Somehow in the end, we liked that. That's the second, I would say, very unfinished project after Saclay. We're so happy with it. And we were last in the competition. And we thought, how come people hate that so much? I think that's probably because it was good, I thought. Well, you know, it has a life as a project, you know, I guess.
Exactly, spot on.
I would say this one because, I'm not sure in English how you say, clivant. Like, you know, there are things, there are objects that are very separate people, you know. And that's in the sense they are political because you're either for it or against it. There's no neutral position possible. And probably this is one of these objects that people may, of course, we do like them, but we're always surprised that people hate the project so much. We're just meant to be nice to you. So, you know, so, there must be something good somewhere.
Thank you, Studio Moto, for leaving your constructions unfinished. Please keep going against architecture. Merci.
Thank you for the discussion. Thank you for studying our work.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
I did, and I have to say that I was enchanted by it. I really liked and learned a lot from it. And this is a good part of the podcast.
We have a new book being released. It's called Holy Highway. There may be lots of stuff that we've already talked about many times, but we just brought everything into that new book.
Thank you.
Wow. Ta-da.
Ta-da. Here it is. So it's partly images from, you know, mobile phones mixed with projects, totally random, and text, French and English. It's a pack of different things brought together. It will be open to interpretation as well.
When will it be launched?
It should be released now. It was published by Cariatid Editions and Arc en Rêve Bordeaux.
I'll look up for it. Very nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Merci.
Thank you for listening. Did you know you can also take part in this episode? Go to arquitecturaentrevistas.com and upload images of projects that came to your mind while listening to this episode. For each episode, you will find a cloud of references uploaded by listeners all over the world. Of course, you can check on this collection anytime for your own projects as well. Hit the follow button for more thoughts on architecture and catch daily updates on Instagram. Obrigada!